Hello and welcome to Two Peds in a Pod, medical education podcast from the Children's Emergency Department in Derby. My name's Ian Lewins, one of the consultants there, and today's podcast is going to be very much a research-themed podcast. And I'm very pleased to be involved in a department that's involved in research. We've had some fantastic doctors involved and particularly some excellent research nurses. And we've been involved in studies such as the Eclipse and currently CAPIT and FORCE. And when you think about research, I think in the UK and social media and people involved, two names to me come to mind. The first one is one of our previous guests, Damien Rowland. And the second is today's guest, and that is Dr. Tom Waterfield, who's a PM doc and researcher at the Queen's University in Belfast. Good afternoon, Tom, and welcome.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on. That's quite a kind introduction, I think, even to be on the same breath as Damien Rowland is quite an honour.
Oh, he's not that important. Don't.
I would have said Damien Rowland and Mark Little. But
yes,
anyway,
maybe so.
No, they would have been my two.
And we're going to talk about a study that you've been heavily involved in, which we're using in Derby, and that's the petechiae in children study, the PIC study. So first of all, tell me a bit about how you sort of got involved in this study.
So for me, it was an interesting one. So I started my training as a paediatric ACF, and a bit like probably lots of people, my research didn't quite follow my clinical interest. So it started off around allergy, which was very interesting. But then as time went on, I became more and more interested in peds emergency medicine. So kind of took a bit of a break. I took a bit of time away from research and focused more on clinical. And then just with Peruki, with Damien, who you mentioned, with Mark, there became some more opportunities to kind of get back involved in research. And this coincided with an interest I'd had in looking after a child who developed meningococcal through my time in intensive care. And just made me look back and think about how we approach the diagnosis of, you know, severe infection, and particularly meningococcal infection. So a little bit of, I wanted to do some research. This was quite emotive. And then looking around at what Peruki had asked for in terms of research, two of their kind of top, I think, 10 or 20 aims were around fever and non-blanching rash. Yeah. So kind of all those things together led to the kind of beginnings of the idea of the project.
Okay. So for those people who've not sort of got involved and not heard of it, what is PIC about? What are you looking at?
So essentially, one of the most widely known or well kind of publicised symptoms for serious infection, including meningococcal, is a non-blanching rash. And so we find, obviously, we get parents presenting appropriately with children with a non-blanching rash, and we also get clinicians who are quite clued into that as a significant risk for more severe infection. But then when we actually started looking at it and looking at the background, a lot of our evidence for our current practice is pretty dated. So, and actually when I say dated, I mean we're talking pre-late 90s, so pre-men-C vaccine, certainly pre-men-B vaccine. Yeah. And we thought actually it might be worth looking at this again, because we weren't sure. There was a feeling, or there was a sense, that we were perhaps treating lots and lots of children just in case, appropriately so, but perhaps giving children invasive, you know, procedures and antibiotics that they didn't need. And then there's still, you know, every year there's still cases of delayed, you know, late diagnosis. Yeah. So there was a feeling that we just didn't quite have it quite right.
Okay.
So, sorry.
Yeah, go on. I mean, one of the things when I saw this was I was involved very, very loosely in the late 90s in sort of collecting data for the, I think, the original studies, trying to sort of come up with a protocol, which sort of forms the basis of the Newcastle, Birmingham, Liverpool algorithm that we use locally. And that was sort of looked at again, I think, two, three, four years ago, looking at, you know, what's the sensitivity and specificity, particularly versus the NICE guidance. And sensitivity was really quite good, and specificity, okay, not quite so good, but not bad. And when I looked at PIC, I thought, what is this going to add to what we already do? What is it going to add? What do you think it's going to help us with?
I think to just kind of pad that out, at the moment, my opinion is that the Newcastle, Birmingham, Liverpool algorithm is that would be my preferred algorithm over NICE.
Yeah.
That's my opinion at the moment. I can't prove that. The algorithm itself, although the publication, so Andrew Reardon's publication came out 2016, I think it was.
Yes.
The data was collected mostly in the 90s, so I think they have 600 patients and about 150 of them with invasive meningococcal infection. So based on that, yes, it's sensitive. It's actually, the specificity is very, very good. But I'm not sure that represents what we're actually seeing coming through the emergency department. So it doesn't feel that one in four children that we see with a fever and an unmatching rash have meningococcal infection. And certainly the data that we're already collecting would reflect that the risk is much, much lower than that.
Sure.
So the only issue I suppose we have with NICE and the existing clinical practice guidelines is that they were written and assessed at a time when meningococcal infection was much more likely.
Yeah.
And also the population that they were assessing isn't quite the same. So when you really dig into these studies, a lot of them are actually children who have been admitted with fever, non-blanching rash and concern of meningococcal, or in the Andrew Reardon paper, children that were put onto this pathway at the clinician's discretion.
Mm.
So what we suspected was happening was lots and lots of slightly milder illness children weren't actually ever getting into these studies.
Okay.
They're then written up, saying one in four children with fever and non-blanching rash have meningococcal. And that guidance is then expanded out to general practice, A&E, and it's affecting the care of perhaps a different population, a different group.
Okay.
So we kind of want to look at it and say, right, every child that comes in with a fever and non-blanching rash and that would or should enter into these pathways, we want to know what's happening to every single one of them, so that we actually get a real feel for what we're doing.
Okay.
There was one study that was done in the States. At the top of my head, I haven't got the reference, but I can get it for you and you can put it on your podcast. It's just a similar study was done in an A&E department in America years ago, where they just looked at every single kid that came through and they had around a 1% risk.
Yeah.
So fever, non-blanching rash, 1% risk of an meningococcal. And that probably, to me, feels about right.
Yes, I'd certainly agree with that. And as you say, the population, particularly with the introduction of the MenB vaccine, is almost, has significantly changed, to the extent that in our department not too long ago, we had a child with a proper meningococcal rash who, interestingly, was unvaccinated. And whilst we were treating this child, all the junior doctors came and had a look because they just hadn't seen a child with a proper meningococcal rash, which was so different to my experience as a junior doctor sort of 10, 15, 20 years ago. So yeah, you're almost certainly right. It's a different population that we're looking at.
I think at the end of the study, what we should be able to do is tell you with a fair amount of confidence the risk, first of all. So that's the one thing we actually don't really know. You have a child in front of you with a fever and non-blanching rash. What's the risk and some of the features that make them high risk, but actually to quantify that, and then we should be able to independently validate the guidelines that are out there. So there's a few, but there's three that particularly I'm really interested in, again on a slightly personal level, and that is the NICE guidance, the Newcastle, Birmingham, Liverpool, and then there's actually it's an unpublished guideline from Nottingham, which was based on all of the research that they did in the late 90s, which has a group of children, so if it's SVC distribution only and they're well, have no investigations and are essentially discharged.
Yeah.
So there are some variations in practice, and it'd be nice to be able to independently validate and say, look, this out of all of the guidance, this is the one that appears to be the best in terms of identifying all of the cases and minimising the number of children we treat unnecessarily.
Okay. So let's talk about the study itself. What are your inclusion criteria?
So if the child presents to the emergency department with a new non-blanching rash and a fever or a history of fever, they're essentially eligible for inclusion in the study.
And that can be a reported fever at home. It doesn't have to be a recorded fever within the ED. Is that correct?
No. So we know that if they have a fever at home, the risk is similar to if they have a fever in the emergency department. And that was one of the things with Andrew Ridd's work. They talk about actually a fever outside of not having a fever in the ED itself is not that reassuring. I think that was fairly new then. I don't think it's as new.
Mm.
I think it's fairly well accepted now. That said, it's unlikely that it'll have absolutely no history of any kind of fever. It just may have been that it's occurred at home.
And thinking about then exclusion criteria, I presume no fever gets you excluded. Is there any age cutoff to this?
So we don't have an age cutoff, just because there doesn't appear to be any age cutoffs in the existing guidance. The only exclusion criteria we've got are children with known conditions which would give them a non-blanching rash, so specifically children with active ITP, yeah. HSP, coagulation disorders, or on chemotherapy.
Sure.
Something where they may have presented, it would be the first time, so if you had a child presented with ITP, diagnose them, but then obviously if they were to reattend 3 or 4 days later with an intercurrent viral illness, we wouldn't look to re-include them.
Okay. Okay, so I've got my child, they've got a fever, they're not unwell, but they've got a particular rash. What happens next? How do I recruit them, and what do the parents do?
So this is, I suppose, where we might be slightly different to other studies, in that we try to make it as easy to recruit patients as possible. So, because you said, if we go back to our initial aims, we want a really fair picture of everyone that's coming through. So if we only focus on children that are admitted or whatever, we actually skew that. So if a child comes in, we have an electronic case report form, there is also a paper version of it, and essentially we can start to record their clinical data as they arrive, as is convenient, and as prospectively as possible, which is again another advantage of our study over some of the previous work. And that can be done by the clinical team, rather than having to be specific research staff. And it's designed to be kind of very minimal in terms of workload. There's no discussion around consent at that point. The data's collected. Then essentially the consent discussion occurs at the kind of first appropriate opportunity, and we can maybe explain what I mean by that in a moment. And then we have a second case report form, which is essentially data that's not open to bias, not necessarily acquired prospectively, and that relates to things like length of stay, antibiotics given, blood culture PCR results, and that's all completed later on. So I think we try to make it easy so that the data can be captured as close to the attendance as possible, as prospectively as possible, by kind of without having to have specific research staff on the floor to do it.
And certainly our experience has been actually, it's a very easy sort of study to do. Explaining to parents, I'm not allocating it to one arm or the other. It is simply we are collecting data to find out what's the best way of treating things, and what's the best approach. That seems to actually, most parents feel very comfortable with that. Is that your experience?
Yeah. So we've got 35 sites, and we've had just over 700 children recruited, and running at a decline rate of just under 1%. We did quite a lot of work, so it started in Belfast essentially as a pilot. You mentioned Eclipse. I worked with Kerry Wolfall, who's a sociologist at Liverpool University and essentially an expert in deferred consent and children's emergency research. And we have just submitted a paper on it, essentially looking at parents' feedback from that pilot. So we did 15 interviews with families after they'd been through the PIC consent process to kind of better understand the timing, how we can make it as appropriate as possible. And essentially the bottom line was they support research, they support emergency research, they like to discuss the research face-to-face as much as possible, but they're happy, they understand why we come and speak to them afterwards. So they nearly all said they wouldn't feel it would be appropriate to have a research discussion at the same time as you're assessing and initiating treatment, because they think that would be a distraction or it'd be inappropriate. So we think the methods we've got are pretty good in terms of you pick the first kind of appropriate time point, which is usually when the parents have seen an improvement in the child
mm-hmm.
and have a plan,
yeah.
which can be quite quickly. It can be an A&E. It can be the next day if they're sick. An intensive care, it could be a week. But it's about timing them around when the family's ready and it's kind of appropriate. But no, we've had it. It's been very, very well accepted.
Mm.
And we haven't had a kind of systematic same concern that's come up. And looking at, you know, speaking to Damien, Mark, other people involved in other studies, we're getting very similar kind of feedback that's been said before. So all in all, it's pretty positive.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, in the time it's been running, 700 recruited patients is really quite impressive. Do you have is it running for a time period or for a certain number that you want to recruit? What's the end point?
So this is the thing that's more, it's kind of evolved more recently. So this started as a PhD project feasibility study in Belfast. We recruited well, we got fantastic feedback from parents, we got Pruki support, we got NAHR portfolio adoption, which opened lots of opportunities in England because that makes research departments want to get involved in the study. And we essentially rolled into a large observational study with a view that we'd probably need to stop at some point and repeat it or extend it. Recruitment's been so good in the last couple of months. We've made the decision with Pruki to extend the study for another winter.
Okay.
So we're going to run until the 1st of March 2020. With the hope, based on the last kind of 2-3 months recruitment rates, of picking up maybe 2,000 children, with the hope of essentially being the kind of best available evidence for children with non-blanching rash, and to try and pick out kind of the risk and what we should be doing with these children.
Okay, so 2020 is now the new cutoff. So you're going to get a decent number of kids in that, aren't you?
So we're going to have, you know, 3 winters, 2 winters with nearly all the sites open, a good number of children in terms of face validity. I think the issue we're going to have now is with meningococcal being as rare as it is, we're not going to get, you know, 3 sites, 2 years, 150 cases, which you had for the research, particularly things like Andrew Reardon's research. We're going to be looking at, you know, that could be 30 cases out of 2,000 children. So it's going to be harder, I think, to define a new clinical practice guideline from scratch. I don't think we'll have necessarily enough cases of meningococcal, but I think we will be able to really inform on the risk. And I think we'll be able to validate the guidelines out there and perhaps point towards which one is most useful.
Okay.
And it's just putting some context in. So it could be that the risk becomes low enough that we consider fever and non-blanching rash as a very worrying symptom. But, you know, whether or not that guideline needs opening up, so it's not just meningococcal infection, but actually, you know, we still see the odd case of pneumococcal infection. It's nearly similar rate of newly diagnosed. See, febrile neutropenia is a kind of first presentation of a leukemic illness that is actually featuring at a not dissimilar rate as meningococcal now. So, you know, it's that kind of it's just changing that landscape from perhaps before when that was your only really concern was meningococcal to actually, yes, it could be, but there's other things and the risk isn't quite what it was.
And I mean, that's really important. At some other point, are you going to be thinking about other investigations that we can do to even sort of reduce the number of children that are giving antibiotics? I'm thinking, for example, you know, we've sort of talked on Twitter about procalcitonin. Is that something that this study is specifically looking at, or is that for another time?
So we do. So as part of the kind of the pilot feasibility, we looked at additional rapid testing. So we looked at procalcitonin. We looked at adrenomedulin as point of care tests. So we do those in. We do those in the emergency department, and we have different sites. We have a small number of sites doing those tests, and we also have sites looking at essentially point of care PCR and throat swabs. So LAMP or loop mediated isothermal amplification just rolls off the tongue, but essentially a rapid PCR that's very tolerant of biological fluids and can be done at kind of one temperature, which means you can take it out of a lab and put it in A&E. So we will have data from about 300 children.
Okay.
The problem there is that that's so hard to scale when the when actually the number of cases of meningococcal is so low.
Mm.
So realistically, we will publish those outputs. I think there is potentially some benefit to point of care testing, but I think it's unlikely we'll be able to provide you with any clear guidance on whether or not you should use them and where in the pathway.
Mm.
Because again, it's becoming so uncommon.
Yeah. And that's so that one for the future potentially, but it's
well, I mean, as an opinion, I wonder if we're going to come out of this, and the biggest finding from it is going to be that we actually prove what the risk is, and that the risk is, I suspect, in and around 1% of children with fever and non-planned sheet rash, and they typically look quite sick or have a rapidly spreading rash or have purpura.
Yeah.
And actually, though, if you follow the guidance to the letter, very many of these children are treated or would be treated with antibiotics. So looking at challenging those guidelines and developing those so that we get a little bit more balanced in not treating everyone, but also still being able to identify those that that may go on to deteriorate, which is the hardest thing.
Yeah, picking those up, the poorly ones up early, yeah. Fantastic. Lovely. Thank you so much, Tom. That's really interesting. And it's, you know, the more I get involved in doing bits, very, very small bits of research, I think the more interesting it becomes to me. And I think having explained that, I think that's excellent. And where, any thoughts yet as to where you might be publishing this, or is that a bit too far ahead?
So the qualitative work, which is around deferred consent, we have put that in for archives.
Okay.
No guarantee they'll accept that. That was submitted just there yesterday. We'll see. I would like this. I if it went well, I would be looking at something like BMJ, hopefully, fingers crossed, just because I think it has a broad appeal for... it's very UK-based, but I think it would be of interest to A&E, GP, paediatricians, but you sure? You know I'll tweet about it anyway, so... Yes.
Okay, well, good luck with that. And I think that the final thing I just wanted to mention, looking at your Twitter feed, is that, totally unrelated to this, you're running the London Marathon this year, is that right?
So that's, I suppose that's the other thing. So what did you get out of your PhD? It'll be a number of papers and a qualification, and I got a bit fitter. So yeah, I'm running quite a bit the last 12 months. London Marathon in this year for Macmillan Cancer Support. So if anyone wants to sponsor me, that'd be great.
Yeah, and I can see that's currently your pinned tweet. So if you want to sponsor Tom, it's there. Fantastic. Lovely.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom, and all the best, and we'll keep us updated, and we'll keep looking on Twitter and seeing how you're getting on.
Thanks, Ian.
Fantastic.